The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Patricia for the North Carolina Reading Service, and for the next hour I will be reading to you from Time Magazine. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com or call 919-875-8889. Today's edition of Time Magazine is dated May 22/May 29, 2023. The coronation of Charles III is the heading here, and below that in large block lettering is Time in white lettering. As usual, the border is edged in red with a narrow white inner border. Up at the top right hand, a little almost thumbprint area that says our 100th year. Additionally, a caption reads, finally, King. It is Charles III having been crowned here. He wears a very tall, bejeweled crown. He has a vestment of gold brocade that is trimmed with golden ringlets, I guess one would say. And there are designs on the vestment that are not described, but they're in green and a blue and white tone. He's seated on the very old wooden throne chair that has various inscriptions on it, not too legible from this distance in time, probably. He holds a scepter in his left hand. It too is gold with jeweled ornamentation in the middle of the rod and at the top. Beginning with Time Off Opener, which in fact will be highlighted during this hour, the moment Rachel Cargill opens her Brooklyn apartment door, I see the signs of relaxed living. There's a Time to greet me slowly on a Monday morning. There's a letter board displaying not an overcrowded schedule, but the affirming words, this too is the living. There's sunshine streaming in from a balcony where salad greens hang from a pocket plant wall. And there's the soft brandy-colored leather couch where we sit and talk over steaming cups of dark roast coffee served Jamaican style, with thick condensed milk. Jamaica ranks among her happiest places. And this is by Janelle Ross, with reporting by Mariah Espada. Cargill, 34, is a black woman leading a modern multi-hyphenate life. No hyphens there, though. Improbably filled with an abundance of ease, another of her favorite phrases. Her career as an influencer, speaker, and writer began about 6 years ago with the Instagram account at rachel.cargill. Her posts on grief, self-care, and liberation have earned her 1.6 million followers, with over 1 million more following side accounts like those for her businesses, a bookstore in Akron, Ohio, an online self-paced learning platform, and a foundation bringing mental health support to black women and girls. Cargill built her brand on her commitment to racial justice, but what makes her approach and her life particularly remarkable is her insistence that joy and pleasure are as essential as equity and justice in the making of a better world. Racism causes our bodies to be weathered, she says. The repair of that requires being able to sit squarely in your values. You can find more peace when you're spending your time and energy doing the things you want to do, no matter how extraneous they may seem to someone else. Her debut book, A Renaissance of Our Own, a memoir and manifesto on reimagining, out May 16, is a collection of lessons and questions to prompt the reader's own life redesign. The book and the worldview it illuminates are open to all, Cargill tells me, but it was written first and foremost for black women, because silencing, shaming, correcting, ignoring, downplaying, degrading, overburdening, and still demanding more from black women remains the norm. Cargill grew up the youngest in an Ohio family, her father, a man who never provided steady financial support, but showered Cargill with love, died of kidney failure when she was 11. Her mother, whom Cargill describes as industrious and creative, had been disabled by polio as a child. She was fixed on two things, religious salvation and survival. It was she who moved the family to subsidized housing in a nearly all-white, affluent area, hoping to provide Cargill and her two sisters with different opportunities. As a teen, Cargill took note of the stoicism her mother cultivated. In the new book, she describes it as a response to difficult circumstances, the impracticality of falling apart. We're often in deep survival mode, black women, she says. Softness was never offered as a tool. Cargill was a star student, and with her mother, a co-parent to her nieces, nephews, and one cousin. An aunt spent time in jail, and she writes that her sisters became victims of addiction, whose lives collapsed in dysfunction and pain. Cargill was so convinced that caretaking crisis and welfare dependency were her future, she did not initially plan for college. At school, she plastered on a smile. At home, she contemplated jobs that would accommodate parenting, but not render her ineligible for affordable housing. She shudders to admit how little she understood then about race and income, about how race and income can shape one's options. Looking back on it now, I see I was reaching for whatever good fruit I could find to pick off the blighted little tree I felt I'd been assigned in life, she writes. With a cousin's help, Cargill applied to the University of Toledo, but in 2009, before earning a degree, Cargill left school and followed the fellow student she had married to his Ohio hometown, then into a U.S. Air Force Guard unit. Outside her monthly service obligation, she eventually became a stay-at-home wife. She tried to convince herself the security that a religious, military, black man and his orderly family presented would be enough. It wasn't. After she asked for a divorce in 2012, she also untethered herself from the idea that church was the only path to goodness. These decisions began by simply imagining what else might be possible. Sometimes I sit on a step and I rest there a while, she says. Sometimes I skip a few steps and sometimes I go back. You cannot do that when you're on this escalator of expectations from society, religion, family. By the time Donald Trump was inaugurated in 2017, Cargill had spent a few years living in Washington, D.C. and New York. She was dating, exploring her sexuality, and embracing polyamory. She was thinking and reading about gender and feminism. She was savoring the chance to watch Scandal while eating a burrito on the couch alone. She'd bought into the ideal of the girl boss, women who seemed always in possession of copious glitter, Cargill writes in A Renaissance, and to conflate business success or aspiring to it with gains for all women. As thousands converged on Washington and other cities for the Women's March, a photo emerged of Cargill and her friend Dana Suchow, who's white, each raising a fist in protest. People online compared the picture to the iconic 1971 image of white feminist Gloria Steinem and black child care activist Dorothy Pittman Hughes. Then it reached an Instagram account with mostly black followers. The response was quite different. How many commenters wondered, could Cargill find communion in that crowd of overwhelmingly white women, when nearly half of white women, 47%, had voted for Trump? Her answer, she still isn't sure. She had not learned much in school about Ida B. Wells, Mary Church Terrell, or other black women activists. People also hardly mentioned in the feminist texts she'd read as an adult. Only now was she learning white feminism had a track record of sidelining everyone else. So she educated herself, taking her evolving thoughts to social media. Her honesty about her need to learn and her obligation to bring accountability to her feminist work boosted her profile. Her following grew exponentially, also becoming far more diverse. Her social media work led to speaking engagements and helped birth the Loveland Foundation. The foundation began with an idea Cargill had in 2018, while briefly continuing college at Columbia University. There she had access to affordable individual therapy for the first time. It helped her heal, and she wanted to improve access for others. To celebrate her birthday in 2018, she launched a GoFundMe and within months raised over $250,000. Now an official nonprofit, Loveland offers training to therapists of color as well as free mental health care. It provided 6,202 black women and girls with 74,424 hours of free therapy last year. Cargill hopes in the future to offer financial support to therapists and to create policy changes to boost diversity in the field. In 2021, just 19% of the nation's psychology workforce were people of color, and 5% of these were black, per the American Psychological Association. The Sunday before I visited Carlisle's home, she and Charlene Kemmler, CEO of the Loveland Foundation, hosted a brunch at a downtown Manhattan restaurant. There they shared their own experiences with healing with a table of about 20 influencer guests. Kemmler's story, her family staged an intervention because she started therapy after her father's death, set off knowing laughter and similar testimonials about family distrust for mental health care. Cargill has a way of bringing whimsy to the most serious of purposes. On this rainy Sunday, she spoke of revolution while dressed in a sequined caftan. She strives to stay her easeful self at all times. I do not want to feel continuously at the mercy of the weather, she says. She's speaking metaphorically, the weather of politics, of people's perceptions. I want to be good whatever the weather is, and that takes a self-knowing, she says, that cannot be handed to you from anywhere. Not from your parents, not from your religion, not from your job. Joy lives inside you. Time Off recommends Spring Ahead, the bounty of TV's new awards season. There are several very short reviews here, and this is the introductory paragraph. The annual TV calendar looks quite different from what preceded it in the 20th century, and even the rhythms it was settling into a few years ago. Spring used to be the season of finales, as shows wrapped for summer hiatus. Now, as you might have noticed, the weeks between Easter and Memorial Day are packed with new releases. And these aren't just any debuts. They're some of the splashiest, Paramount Plus's Fatal Attraction reboot, and the most expensive, Amazon spy thriller Citadel, projects of the year. Marquee stars are everywhere, from Kerry Russell as a green ambassador in Netflix's The Diplomat to Woody Harrelson in HBO's Watergate romp, White House Plumbers. This glut is due in large part to a streaming landscape where Netflix, Hulu, and Amazon are no longer the major players. Not only is there more TV in general, there are also more platforms competing for subscription dollars. And winning awards is one way to convince potential customers that your original content is worth the price. Since the Emmy deadline is May 31, spring has become television's own version of Oscar season, except more daunting, because each title spans multiple episodes. To help you prioritize that queue, here are 10 of Emmy season's best new and upcoming shows. And all are reviewed by Judy Berman, presumably. Dead Ringers, a reboot of David Cronenberg's Twisted 1988 psychological thriller, could have been terrible, yet somehow it feels even more subversive than the original, a psychosexual horror odyssey about identical twin gynecologists, both played by Jeremy Irons, and the woman who threatens to tear them apart. Mastermind, Alice Birch. Succession, Lady Macbeth, recasts the doctors as women. But this is no glib gender flip. It is an inspired choice, with Birch casting the versatile Rachel Weisz and submerging the story in the bloody realities of women's bodies, appetites, and ambitions in a way that could not be done with men. That's on Prime Video. Dear Mama, more than 26 years have passed since Tupac Shakur was murdered at age 25. One of the most brilliant rappers of all time, he also remains something of an enigma. Is it possible to reconcile the disparate facets of his legacy, the visionary poet, the righteous activist, the gentle lover, the self-proclaimed thug, the man who served time for sexual assault, the martyr? Alan Hughes, The Defiant Ones, makes a compelling attempt in this five-part documentary that braids together Tupac's biography and that of his fraught relationship with his equally complicated mother, Black Panther Party leader Afeni Shakur from FX. Bupkis, Bupkis, messy and erratic, but also insightful and often funny. This dramedy lightly fictionalizes the tabloid magnate life of its co-creator and star, SNL alum Pete Davidson. Bupkis is a family dramedy more than a showbiz sitcom. Most episodes take place in Pete's borough of Staten Island, where he lives in the basement of a house occupied by his doting mother, Edie Falco, and absorbs wisdom from his no-nonsense grandfather, Joe Pesci, who has terminal cancer. In balancing thoughtful engagement with his own struggles from drug abuse to mental illness, and moments of goofy fun, including an extended tribute to the Fast and Furious franchise, Davidson proves to be an incisive narrator of his own story. And that's on Peacock. American-born Chinese. This adaptation of Jean Luen Yang's graphic novel fuses realism and fantasy. Every kid, Ben Wang, is starting to ingratiate himself with the jocks at his high school when he's saddled with guiding a foreign exchange student, Wei Chen, Jim Liu, because they are both Chinese. Little does he know that his new pal is actually the son of a god from Chinese mythology. A mix of action, epic, and teen comedy, American-born Chinese is also an allegory for Jin's ambivalence toward his heritage. Adults will want to watch for a stacked cast that includes Everything Everywhere All at Once, Oscar winners Kei Hui Kwan and Michelle Yeoh. That's from Disney Plus. A Small Light. Mia Pagis did not realize when she started working as a secretary for Anne Frank's father, Otto, that she was destined for greatness. Nearly a decade later, when the Nazis marched into Amsterdam, she helped his family hide for more than 2 years in a secret annex. After the Franks were discovered and deported to concentration camps, she saved Anne's diary. A Small Light tells Gies's story. A bracing, emotional, but not excessively sentimental account of a regular woman's resistance to fascism, anchored by an exquisite lead performance from Belle Pauli. A hero, but before that a human, Pauli's Mip is an ideal embodiment of the cause for which her anti-fascist cohort is fighting. And that's National Geographic. Working. What we do all day. Inspired by Studs Terkel's classic oral history, Working, executive producer and narrator Barack Obama documents what regular people from all levels of the American labor force do at work. Each of this docuseries' 4 episodes profiles a trio of workers, moving up the hierarchy from service employees to the white-collar middle class to highly paid knowledge workers, and finally the executives who control the conditions of everyone below them. Attuned to technological and generational changes in the workforce, and sensitive to how misleading terms like low-skill labor can be, the series makes a quiet statement by taking viewers out of their own class-based bubbles. Netflix. Slip. So Lister Jones, Band-Aid, wrote, directed, executive produced, and stars in this delightful lo-fi multiverse show about a 30-something in a stagnant marriage. Fresh off a fight with her husband, Lister Jones May sleeps with a famous musician and wakes up in a parallel universe where she's married to him instead. A subsequent string of hookups offers glimpses into other lives she could be living. In one, she is a queer mom wed to Emily Hampshire from Schitt's Creek. Russian Doll and Search Party are more ambitious, audacious shows, but Slip slots in comfortably among them as a lighter example of the same New York City surrealist sensibility on Roku channel. Silo. Sci-fi fans might have a new favorite show in this thoughtful adaptation of the books by Hugh Howey. In a silo-shaped underground city that houses the last 10,000 people on Earth, it's taken as an article of faith that the outside world is toxic to humans. That assumption comes into question when the wife, Rashida Jones, of the sheriff, David Oyelowo, finds evidence that suggests powerful forces within the silo are hiding something major. At once a portrait of a dystopian society and a mystery investigated by a fascinating detective, Rebecca Ferguson, Silo is smart sci-fi, grounded in skillful world-building and solid character development. Apple TV Plus. Queen Charlotte. Shonda Rhimes personally created this spin-off of her wildly popular show Bridgerton, and it shows in an addictive season that balances Regency romance with palace intrigue, a la Scandal. Inspired by a British queen who may have had African ancestry, the flamboyant middle-aged Charlotte, Golda Rochuval is a beloved Bridgerton character. While Rochuval appears in a parallel timeline, Queen Charlotte is mostly an origin story, and India Armetifo is sure to break out as the headstrong teen who weds King George III, Corey Milchreist. Their chemistry's off the charts, yet George remains distant from his bride. Students of history won't be shocked to learn his secret, but the mystery still makes for a compelling plot driver on Netflix. Mrs. Davis, like Damon Lindelof's past hits, from Lost to The Leftovers to Watchmen, this wild sci-fi drama that Lindelof created with Tara Hernandez is concerned with the ways in which faith and morality persist in a world that has replaced religion with other forms of belief. In this case, that timely substitute is an AI nicknamed Mrs. Davis that functions like an all-powerful Siri, whispering gently into the earbuds of users around the globe. Played with sparkling intelligence by Betty Gilpin, the show's heroine, Sister Simone, is a mouthy Nevada nun who believes the AI killed her dad. When Mrs. Davis offers her one wish, if she can procure the Holy Grail, Simone seizes the quest to try to shut down the algorithm forever. From Peacock. Here are Time Off Reviews Movies, a documentary not about illness, but about life, by Stephanie Zakarik. If it were up to us to choose the fates of the performers we care about, millions of people would want to wish Michael J. Fox's Parkinson's away. Few actors of the 1980s and 90s gave us as much pleasure. On TV's Family Ties, his characterization of teenage conservative Alex P. Keaton was so artful that even diehard liberals could get a kick out of it. In 1985, as the charmingly incredulous Marty McFly, he traveled back in time to make a match between his own parents. And in the sharp 90s-era sitcom Spin City, he played peripatetic New York City Deputy Mayor Mike Flaherty, doing his best to avert municipal crises despite his bumbling staff. Fox's nervous energy was a kind of radiance, an animating force that audiences warmed to. After he was diagnosed with Parkinson's disease in 1991, at age 29, he hid his condition for as long as he could. When he finally revealed his illness to the world, it seemed cosmically unfair that such a likable performer, so gifted at physical comedy in particular, should have to suffer this way. There is no way to put a positive spin on Parkinson's. But how we handle the cards we are dealt is everything. And Davis Guggenheim's remarkable documentary, Still, a Michael J. Fox movie, reminds us that a person stricken with a disease does not become that disease. Fox's condition continues to deteriorate as he ages. He is now 61, though the boy he used to be is still right there in the impish planes of his face. His limitations have increased. He's frequently injured as the result of unavoidable falls, but he's still Michael J. Fox. And Guggenheim, an astute interviewer, paints a picture of where he is today that's unsparing, but also terrifically, if also somewhat darkly, funny. When Guggenheim asks Fox where he thinks he'll be in 20 years, his brow furrows, and it takes a few seconds for the answer to travel from brain to mouth. I'll either be dead or a pickle, he says. The kind of spontaneous out there joke you have to be Michael J. Fox to make. What is striking about Still is how celebratory it is. This is not the story of a wonderful actor felled by an illness. It is the story of a wonderful actor, period, beginning nearly at the beginning with a reenactment of an incident in which toddler Michael, growing up in Canada, runs off to the local candy store on his own. And moving briskly through Fox's career, which ambled along for several years before taking off like a rocket. "I was the boy prince of Hollywood," he says, recalling the multiple sports cars he was able to buy once he hit it big. A vintage TV clip shows Shelley Winters asking him point blank who he's sleeping with. Before marrying fellow actor Tracy Paulin in 1988, he most certainly had his pick. Guggenheim and his editor, Michael Hart, make artful use of clips from Fox's films to illustrate the events of his life. A sequence in which Fox describes a particularly grueling 3 months, during which he worked on Family Ties by day and spent most of the night filming Back to the Future, is almost alarmingly effective. Just watching it makes you feel pooped. But the most extraordinary scenes in still are the ones showing Fox with Paulin and their grown children, sitting around the kitchen and making one another laugh, sometimes not in spite of Fox's limitations, but because of them. One of his greatest gifts is that he can laugh at himself, maybe more so now than ever. At one point in the documentary, Guggenheim realizes he has not asked Fox if he's in pain. "I am in intense pain," Fox answers. When Guggenheim asks why he has not mentioned it at any point during filming, Fox says plainly, "It didn't come up." A line so funny it hurts. There is a photo here. It's a headshot of Fox in still. He looks like a 61-year-old. His hair is kind of ruffled up, mussed up. It's medium dark with some gray in it, I would say, and he has a mustache that is gray. He's looking pensive. His eyes are blue. He doesn't look angry or sad or happy or delighted. He just looks pensive. His chin is resting on his right hand. He's wearing a dark blue shirt. The brief news. Politics, playing magic, the gathering with Senate hopeful Lucas Kuntz, that's K-U-N-C-E, by Minnie Racker. When Missouri Senate candidate Lucas Kuntz logs onto Zoom for our game of magic, the gathering, he is not messing around. He has what he calls his streamer setup, an extra computer monitor, and has opted for Standard, a dynamic version of the strategic trading card game, where we build decks ahead of time using cards from the most recent sets. I do not often play Standard, so I have net-decked, built my deck based off an online list. I soon see a problem. I do not recognize Kuntz's deck at all. It's one he's built himself. He plays Field of Ruin, which destroys one of my non-basic lands, and does it again by bringing Field back with Conduit of Worlds. He then plays Jace, the Perfected Mind, to dump my entire deck into my graveyard, an uncommon strategy that wins him the game. Few politicians advertise their interests in a hobby as nerdy as Magic the Gathering, but for Kuntz, a clean-cut populist Marine vet, magic has been such an integral part of his life for 3 decades that it has seeped into his political identity. He draws a comparison between his campaign strategy and magic. "I am not meta-decking," he says, a similar term to net-decking. "I want to do something different." This is Kuntz's second Senate bid. During his campaign for Missouri's open seat last year, he got buzz in the national press as the sort of Democrat who might have a shot in a state turning darker red. He is an antitrust advocate who supports abortion access and wants to repeal Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act to regulate big tech. Kuntz lost the primary to Anheuser-Busch heiress Trudy Bush Valentine, who went on to lose to Republican Eric Schmidt. Now Kuntz seeks to challenge Republican incumbent Josh Hawley for the Senate seat that comes up in 2024. Kuntz continues the magic metaphor. Josh Hawley, corporate country club Republican, completely net-decked. In that party, there's two net-decked paths to winning. It's big corporate money, or you've got to be a culture crazy type. Kuntz's long-shot campaign raised $1.1 million in the first quarter of the year, more than Hawley did in the same period. Kuntz, 40, grew up in a working-class neighborhood where his family lived paycheck to paycheck. He started playing magic in middle school to escape, he says. When I ask what card best represents him, Kuntz pulls out a binder containing more than 50 copies of Wanderlust, a card depicting a little guy with a walking stick gazing out at a hilltop. As a kid who did not know if he'd ever get to see the world, Kuntz loved that art. He says he has nearly every version of the card ever made. Kuntz did get to see the world. He got a Pell Grant and attended Yale. Magic helped him scrape by then, too. I had a mint condition alpha ancestral recall, Kuntz says, naming a card that now sells for upwards of $10,000. He sold it to help buy a new car. He later joined the Marine Corps and deployed to Iraq and Afghanistan, where he and other service members played the game to decompress. These days, he plays on the virtual platform that hosted our game, MTG Arena, while making fundraising calls or traveling between campaign stops. When a conservative news outlet recently called him a nerd for his love of the game, Kuntz's tweet proudly confirming the story went viral, with many Magic players saying it prompted them to donate. Around midnight, I am still thinking about my loss. I log on to Arena and play against a stranger. I see one of my friends is online. It is Lucas Kuntz, up late, still playing. In a slightly altered reprise of the cover photo of this edition of Time, this caption reads, King Charles III and Queen Camilla watch the ceremonial flypast of more than 60 military aircraft from Buckingham Palace. The cover photo is a portrait showing King Charles III, his face not quite straight ahead, or not quite in profile, but I'd say three-quarters so. Here we see the king and queen from the back. Very predominant are the tall crowns on their heads. Camilla's hair is blonde. Charles's is gray. They're wearing the ermine robes for the coronation. They're apparently standing on the balcony as they're watching the ceremonial fly past. One sees just a margins and bits of the Queen's lovely dress. It's an ivory color with lots of gold embroidery and seed pearls and sequins. And the back of her ermine cape, which is at least floor length, I believe she had young pages carrying it, and in addition, some of her, or two of her attendants, the women who stayed close to her, were helping. The ermine itself is white with these black kind of tails on it, and the color of the cloak or a cape seems to be a very dark red, like burgundy, but it's almost indistinguishable because it blends in with not the background, which is white, but with the way the photograph is being taken. However, on the back of the Queen's cloak, ermine-trimmed cloak, is some beautiful embroidery. It's trailing flowers. And supposedly they depict the four national flowers of the United Kingdom. There appear to be shamrocks at the top and then daffodils. And I can't see what else is there because it's lost within the folds of the cape fabric. But that cloak was designed and handmade for her by the Royal Needleworkers, Royal Needleworkers Academy. King Charles's ermine cape is much longer than Queen Camilla's, and it too is atop a longer flowing robe in a dark color. I don't know if it's a dark purple, perhaps. And there's also some kind of a very long gold medallion studded chain that reaches perhaps from the shoulders of his ermine cape about halfway down. So it's long and it's gold and it's probably heavy too. And of course the crowns on their head are conspicuous with jewels and ornamentation. And they are also a dark color, maybe purple, I don't know, but it's very dark. And there's this contrasting white, which is in their foreground, but in the background of the photo. All right, next is Beyond Bollywood. This is under the culture listing. Actually, I'm going to skip ahead past that article. I'm going to skip ahead to some shorter articles. This one is very long, the Beyond Bollywood deal. Okay. More movies here. This is movies Tough Love Glammed Up, and this is by Stephanie Zakarik. Not since Stella Dallas has a mother made so many selfless sacrifices for her daughter. Not since Taken has a protective parent fended off so many rotten baddies. Mush those two genres together, the classic women's picture and the pulpy rage-driven action adventure, and you get The Mother, in which J-Lo plays the mother to end all mothers, a skilled assassin who slinks out of retirement to protect the daughter, Luce Paez, she was forced to give up 12 years ago. If that sounds like fun, it is, but almost in spite of itself. Director Nikki Carroll, Whale Rider, Mulan, approaches the material reverently as a parable about the strength of women. Lopez's The Mother, her character, a womb with balls, has no name. Thanks nothing of wasting the sexy bad guys. They are played by Gael Garcia Bernal and Joseph Fiennes, who threaten her tiny nuclear family. In one of the movie's most compelling scenes, she lectures her daughter on the damage tofu has wrought upon the world. This is some pretty tough love. But how can we not laugh with joy, not derision, when we see our favorite mom hunting stag in Alaska, for survival purposes only, while wearing the luscious fur-trimmed hood this side of Fendi? Whatever Lopez does, she does it glamorously. The mother needs to be watched with the largest group of J-Lo fans you can assemble, ideally people who know artfully applied highlighter when they see it in the wild. And another Stephanie Zakarik review here. Under movies, a romantic thriller in which festering secrets give way to love. By design, writer-director Paul Schrader's three most recent films, First Reformed 2027, The Card Counter 2021, and now Master Gardener, constitute a loose trilogy entwined around the idea of male guilt. In all three cases, troubled men are at least partly redeemed by love. You can call that device corny, but perhaps that's only because in a landscape of fantasy franchises and action retreads, we have forgotten the deep pleasures of the romantic thriller, movies in which darkness and light reach toward each other with a fateful kiss. Schrader's long career is dotted with these thrillers, and he is still among the best at making them. In Master Gardener, Joel Edgerton plays Narvel Roth, a somber horticulturist with a past rooted in racist hatred. He is in charge of the lavish historic garden of rich, uppity white lady Norma Haverhill, Sigourney Weaver, who one day informs him that he must give her headed-for-trouble grandniece Maya Quintessa Swindell a job. She also informs Narvel in icy, crisp, grand dame tones that Maya is of mixed blood. Edgerton's Narvel has the meaty face of a scrapper who's lost a few fights, but won many more. If this is also a guy who can pick up a clod of moist earth and divine its essence by scent alone, Maya is drawn to him at the risk of letting her own guard down, and Swindell as simultaneously inquisitive and all-knowing as a butterfly plays that tension beautifully. If you have seen First Reformed and the Card Counter, you may wonder how Schrader can find anything more to say about this particular kind of masculine anguish, this feeling of culpability for either personal sins or more global ones. But there's a fantasy element to Master Gardener that bolsters the movie's convictions rather than weakening them. Can human beings really change? In Master Gardener, they can, like a dying plant that one day turns to face the sunlight, suddenly knowing all that it has been missing. And the brief news, media. She was Tucker Carlson's office mom. Now she is suing by Charlotte Alter. At first, Abby Grossberg thought Fox News would be her big break. When she got a job as the main producer of Sunday Morning Futures with Maria Bartiromo in 2019, she was responsible for booking guests, meeting newsmakers, even sitting in on phone calls with President Donald Trump. In 2022, she moved to Tucker Carlson Tonight, where she became head of booking. But in recent weeks, Grossberg has filed two lawsuits against her former employer. In one suit, filed in Delaware, she alleges Fox News lawyers bullied her into giving false and misleading testimony in Dominion Voting Systems' defamation case against Fox, which the network settled in April for $787.5 million. According to Grossberg, the lawyers for the company coached her to shade her deposition in the Dominion lawsuit and coerced her to implicate herself and Bartiromo rather than Fox News executives. May 9, Grossberg dropped that lawsuit, although her lawyer has said she intends to refile it in a different jurisdiction. In another lawsuit filed in New York, Grossberg alleges she was unfairly denied a promotion at Sunday Morning Futures, and that the work environment at Tucker Carlson Tonight was so hostile to women, it triggered a nervous breakdown. She is now suing for economic, punitive, and emotional distress damages. Grossberg was fired from Fox March 24. She alleges the company fired her because she disclosed information about the Dominion case in her suit. Fox says the termination was related to her performance. Fox News engaged an independent outside counsel to immediately investigate the concerns raised by Ms. Grossberg, which were made following a critical performance review, a Fox News spokesperson said in a statement. We will continue to vigorously defend Fox against her unmeritorious legal claims, which are riddled with false allegations against the network and our employees. Carlson's attorney did not reply to a request for comment. In an extended interview with Time, Grossberg offered her perspective about the charges at the core of both of these lawsuits. That Fox's relentless pursuit of ratings, combined with alleged gender discrimination at the company, created an environment where falsehoods and conspiracy theories thrived unchecked. On her first day at Tucker Carlson Tonight, Grossberg says she walked into the office to find it plastered with photos of Nancy Pelosi in a bikini. Soon, she says, she noticed one of the senior producers had a mirror on his desk with the C word written on it. And every time I spoke out, I was excluded from meetings, further marginalized, berated in front of my team, Grossberg recalls. There was a feeling of, she's the office mom. While she never met Carlson in person, he worked mostly remotely. Grossberg says he would often demand staff find support for what he wanted to air, whether it was true or not. Tucker sent marching orders every morning of what he wanted and what the angles were going to be, and many of them were conspiracy theories, she says. It was always like, here's my point of view, this is what I want to say tonight, find somebody who will say that. Carlson's researchers combed right-wing fever swamps for incendiary stories, Grossberg alleges. They would raise things and be like, we just can't find this. We cannot connect these dots. And then it would be on the air anyway, she says. They looked at the ratings minute by minute. Carlson seemed secure at Fox. Bartiromo was different. Soon after arriving at Fox News, Grossberg says, she sensed Bartiromo had a target on her back. I noticed the misogyny, how she was treated by other people at Fox, Grossberg recalls. She says she was once berated by a Fox senior producer for being too candid with Bartiromo. He said, she's menopausal. She's crazy. We don't tell her things. That article was briefly abridged, and now for Culture Beyond Bollywood by Asta Rajvanshi, Mumbai. That's in Mumbai. Now, this is going to be really abridged because it's a long article. Deepika Padukone never set out to take India to the world. She wanted the world to come to India. As the most popular actress in the world's most populous country, she is often asked if she's going to move to Hollywood. My mission has always been to make a global impact while still being rooted in my country, she says on her home turf in Mumbai one humid morning in April, while on a break from shooting India's first aerial action film, Fighter. It is fitting that Padukone's photo shoot for this story is happening inside Mehboob, M-E-H-B-O-O-B, Studios, home to some of the most legendary movies made in Hindi-language cinema, from the seminal Oscar-nominated Mother India in 1957 to Padukone's own Chennai Express in 2013. The 37-year-old is now a legend in her own right. She's appeared in more than 30 films, won numerous awards, and generated nearly $350 million in global box office revenues. Today, she is the highest-paid actress in India. Among her legions of fans and nearly 74 million followers on Instagram, Padukone is fondly called the Queen of Bollywood. Padukone's 16-year career is an exception to the rule in Bollywood, the cutthroat Hindi-language film industry, known for prizing youth and continually looking for the next new thing. She suspects this has to do with India's growing influence in the world. Indian cinema has transcended borders, and Indians are everywhere, so the fame goes wherever you go, she says. Smartphones, streaming services, and social media have helped find new audiences for India's century-old film industry, which tells about 1,500 stories a year on the screen. At the same time, Netflix and Amazon are also eager to create content that caters to a vast South Asian viewership of nearly 2 billion people around the world. But they're not necessarily looking only at Bollywood. The recent success of Telugu language films like Bahubali and RRR has forced the question of whether Bollywood can still dominate the Indian film industry, which comprises many regional languages. All the while, tensions simmer under the surface as a rightward-leaning Indian government monitors the stories India tells about itself on celluloid. If brands want to capitalize on a new India, which Padukone calls simply an emotion, she knows that stardom has placed her at its fulcrum. There's the India with our roots, our heritage, our history, but there's also a new and young India that's emerging. It's almost time to go. In a few minutes, she will slip out the special exit with her bodyguards. It's these two Indias coming together, she says, that I find really fascinating at this moment. And again, that long article was abridged. We have run out of time for today's episode of Time Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I am Patricia, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com. That's gsuggsinsurance.com. Or call 919-875-8889. Time Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.